you a friend. The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
In my teens, there was a neighborhood fire. It was a pretty big deal. An entire block went up in smoke. It was all local shops, a dry cleaner, a toy and hobby store, the local library, and most horribly, a pet shop. The blaze began on a bitter cold Friday afternoon. I was on my way home from high school when I happened upon the firemen battling the flames. There were several pumpers throwing oceans of water on it, but they just couldn't knock it down because of the ferocious, icy wind. The raw temperature that day was 16 degrees. With a wind chill factor, it was well below zero. The firemen were amazing. Faces beet red, helmets and coats and boots covered with ice from the blowback of the hoses. They never quit, like supermen. Tough, tough dudes. There were a couple of newspaper reporters covering it. This was in Queens, New York. In another city, at another time, it would have been a major story in the evening television news, but it got no broadcast mention. Though it was a hell of a fire, nobody died. Well, except some puppies and parakeets and tropical fish. An entire city block immolated was no match for the gruesome murders and other mayhem that plagued New York every damned night. Once darkness fell, I went home to thaw out and eat dinner. After I did my homework, I went back to see more, but this time I brought my Miranda SensorX camera and a tripod. I was very much into black and white photography then, was constantly developing and printing my own stuff in a makeshift darkroom. On that second visit, flames were no longer visible, but everything was still smoldering. The firemen had lashed hoses to parking meters, and they shot arcs of water high into the air and down onto the embers. The scene had morphed from the sad to the weird. I had never seen anything frozen and smoking at the same time. At home, I loaded a fresh roll of Tri-X into the camera, which I was pushing to ASA 1600. I set up the tripod and started shooting. I was taking my time. I wanted that perfect shot, maybe something I could sell to a newspaper. But before I could finish the roll of film, I could no longer cock the shutter. It had frozen shut. It was that cold. The next day, the fire made the papers, but not in a big way. It was buried on page, I don't know, 7 or 8. Siberia in newspaper real estate. There was a crappy little picture. I thought my pictures were much better, and in retrospect, they were. When I read the story, I was astonished. Almost everything was wrong. The names of the shops, the owners. About the only thing they got right was that there was a fire, and it was in Queens. Just for you, I put on my miner's helmet and dug my photograph out of storage. If you want to have a look at a vista of New York destruction and desolation, literally frozen solid. You can see it at thatlarryshow.com. People have odd impressions of places they've never visited. When I first came out west on a winter recess from college, a journey chronicled in episode 15, Larry's Road Trip to Destiny, that's in the March 2017 tab at thatlarryshow.com. When I arrived in the west, the first thing local kids asked me was if I was in a gang. That was the impression they got from Hollywood. If you were a teenager in New York, you must be a hood in a gang. They also asked me about famous New York places. Not being a baseball fan, they were agog that I'd never been to Yankee Stadium. I only visited the Statue of Liberty once, and that was on a class trip. Madison Square Garden? Well, that was for prize fights and concerts, but it held no special allure. In fact, as a concert venue, it sucks. Grace Slick once said it had the acoustics of a blimp hangar, and she was right. The Empire State Building's best moment was when King Kong punched biplanes while hanging from its blimp mast. Before they stuck a needle-like TV antenna on top, it actually had a blimp mast. As a kid, I read about that blimp mast and thought, why the hell would they tether a blimp to the top of a skyscraper? Would passengers shimmy down the cable like squirrels on a phone line? I went to the top of the building once. The view was great. But the interior, it was a snore, actually kind of gloomy, just a warren of fluorescent-lit offices. A few years ago, it was so infested with rats and roaches, they had to do a top-to-bottom fumigation. Just a few blocks northeast is the Chrysler Building. It's a hell of a lot cooler. Art Deco Divine. But it never got much attention, such as the power of a movie about an overgrown gorilla. Someone recently asked me about the process of making an episode of this show. There is no process. People who work in construction or manufacturing or agriculture, they may think there must be a process, A plus B equals C. Perhaps for some there is, but not for me. For this show, it pretty much goes like what you just heard. Kind of like Tarzan swinging on vines from blimp hangar to blimp mast to recalling an unanswered question from my childhood. What about that nutty blimp mast? The answer is simple, but it carries an extra payload of wisdom. And that's that plenty of guys who are rich and or powerful can be pretty damn stupid. A group of investors that funded the Empire State Building's construction came up with a revised plan that would increase the height by 200 feet to accommodate a blimp mast. This announcement was made by a former four-time New York governor named Alfred E. Smith. He'd just been shellacked by Hoover in the 1928 presidential election. Smith claimed that, quote, passengers would exit the airship down a gangplank, and a mere 7 minutes later could be on the street, ready to experience everything Manhattan had to offer, unquote. Who can imagine that? Well, room temperature IQ Smith could, and his deep-pocketed buddies, and presumably the guys who designed the structure. Maybe, more likely, they just took the money, kept their mouths shut, and laughed. One guy who did not share Smith's vision or childish imagination was a dude that actually knew something about airships, Herr Dr. Hugo Eckener, commander of the Graf Zeppelin, probably the most famous dirigible after the Hindenburg. Eckener politely disagreed with Smith, saying, quote, the notion that passengers would be able to descend an airport-style ramp from a moving airship to the tip of the tallest building in the world, even in excellent conditions, beggars belief. Unquote. No shit. That was Eckener's public statement. Betcha his private statement about Smith and his crew of rich nitwits was a little more colorful. But still, they capped the building with a blimp mast, and one airship actually did dock for 3 entire minutes, and it was very nearly a disaster. The thing was bouncing around in 40-mile-an-hour winds. Alfred E. Smith was a very popular politician, a career politician. While he lacked the smarts to see how a blimp mast was an idiotic idea, he was very skilled at understanding and manipulating and bullshitting people. That's what politicians do. Wonder why those Mad Magazine guys named their half-wit mascot Alfred E. Newman. Any connection? New York has a penchant for electing moron governors, like Andrew Cuomo. Remember the start of the China virus pandemic? Andy Boy was America's governor. There was a major push to run him as a presidential candidate. Teleprompter reading smooth brains were so hot for him, they were declaring themselves Cuomosexuals. Remember that? Then there were the nightly telecasts of the bromance between America's governor and his teleprompter reading sibling, Chrissy. It was like a contest of who could be cuter. The two of them had the world on a yo-yo string. They ruled the airwaves day and night. One was saving New York State, the other was making sure you knew about it. Until people figured out why the New York death count was off the charts. That America's governor was offloading contagious COVID patients from hospitals into nursing homes, and the body count, allegedly due to Andy's stupidity, runs as high as 15,000 snuffed seniors. That's a lot dumber than a blimp mast. What's even more mind-blowing is that all those Cuomo-sexuals did not seem to mind the staggering death count. It was the allegations that Andy was randy and was hitting on women around the office that he created a toxic environment. Well, not nearly as toxic as those nursing homes. But that's what torpedoed his career. A little grab ass and some inappropriate comments to the ladies. And now baby brother Chris has been canned by CNN. Looks like they're purging all things Cuomo. Their father was also governor of New York. He was no prize. In fact, he was a punk. Maybe they'll wipe Governor Mario M. Cuomo's name off that big bridge north of the city. Call it what it originally was, the Tappan Zee, before Governor Andy demanded it be named after his daddy. As long as we're talking names, maybe all the nitwit politicians should be rechristened with that first name and middle initial, huh? Alfred E. Biden, Alfred E. Newsom, etc. It could be fun. Hey, how'd I get here from fires and famous landmarks? You see, there is no process. Oh yeah, New Yorkers don't look twice at famous skyscrapers. Parisians don't visit the Eiffel Tower, and people who live in Los Angeles are oblivious to its tourist attractions. In fact, residents make a point to avoid many of them. If you've ever dreamed of hopscotching through piles of human shit and a gauntlet of meth zombies, visit that Chinese theater on Hollywood Boulevard. You won't be disappointed. But there are a few landmarks that locals love and frequent with regularity. I visited one just this past weekend. It's called Bob's Big Boy, and it's been seen in a lot of movies and TV shows. It's been around since the 40s because it delivers on three fronts critical to restaurant success. The food is good, consistently good. That matters. The service is also good. Friendly chicks with no attitude who just want to get you fed and have you leave happy. Lastly, ambiance. It's like stepping into a time machine circa 1950s. A lot of restaurants have tried to replicate that vibe, right? Johnny Rockets and Ruby's and others, but no matter how they strive to emulate that vintage feel, they miss the mark because it's a replica. It isn't original. It's like those reboots of classic cars, right? Chrysler came out with a new Challenger a while back. That kind of sort of looked like the original, which was one of the coolest bodies ever to come out of Detroit, but the new one, it's okay, but it pales in comparison to the original. About the same time, Chevy rebooted the Camaro with the same results. Bob's Big Boy is original, built in 1949. Plastic, fantastic, mid-century majesty. You step inside and you feel like you're, I don't know, on the set of American Graffiti. Which I recently watched with my younger daughter. It's not that great, but the cars and sets are kick-ass. We walked in and the dude at the counter said it was a 20-minute wait for a table. I asked how about at the counter and he said, "Seat yourself, folks." Why don't people like counters? As long as there's a seat back for comfort, it's actually a more authentically retro dining experience than a table or booth. And the service is faster. By dint of proximity to the kitchen, huh? Which is always right behind the counter. So we sat at the counter. My wife and I split a massive club sandwich that comes with a big pile of fries and a big salad. My daughter had a burger. As I scarfed down the excellent chow, I realized I knew very little about this wonderful place. Turns out it has a fabulous backstory. The dude that founded it was voted least likely to succeed by his high school classmates. Let's take a quick detour regarding that accolade. In today's fucked up, always nurturing, safe space educational environments, anybody suggesting a least likely to succeed award would not only be shut down, they'd probably be criminally prosecuted. But in fact, that award was an integral part of a fantastic American success story. It was bestowed upon one Bob Wyan, who was, by academic standards, a loser, a fuck-up. Bob, he never did his homework, his grades sucked, but he was not afraid of hard work. When his dad went bankrupt, Bob washed dishes at the school cafeteria so he could pay for his own lunch. After graduation, he took a second job as a dishwasher, and the restaurant business fascinated him. He soon was promoted to fry cook, then manager. He studied merchandising and food pricing and the importance of consistent quality, what made menus cool and appetizing. After a few years, he put aside enough jing to make a down payment on a tiny 10-stool hamburger stand in Glendale, California. It was called The Pantry. But he was 300 bucks short, so he sold his DeSoto automobile to close the deal. Without a car in Southern California, you might as well not have legs. That's the measure of Bob's passion. One day, some customer bitched that he wanted something different, so Bob made him a double-decker burger. Presto, Bob's big boy was born. Pretty soon, Bob couldn't make him fast enough, and he eventually opened the fantastic restaurant in 49 that remains the coolest landmark in the city of Burbank, California, and that includes Warner Brothers, Disney, and NBC Studios. Compared to Bob's big boy, those billion-dollar enterprises are beige. At its zenith, Bob's Big Boy encompassed 580 restaurant franchises in 38 states. This from a dude voted least likely to succeed. Bob actually credited that nasty award as part of what motivated him to stellar success. He wanted to prove the bastards wrong. Eventually, he sold out to Marriott. Since then, a melange of NBA fucktards have ground success into failure, until now only six Bob's Big Boys remain. But the original restaurant in Burbank is a touchstone of mid-century Americana, an America that has vanished like pink tones in a twilight sky. A can-do America, a place where the future shined brighter than neon and held all the promise of a blazing western horizon. A place where a penniless dishwasher with a fresh idea could transform himself from least likely to succeed to dazzling success, validated by millions of people across the breadth of a continent, people who were drawn to the brick-and-mortar pastel incarnation of his fantastic imagination. Was there a process? Sure, there has to be for consistency. But before there was a process, there was a magnificent spark of pure creativity that birthed the big boy. For three quarters of a century, people have been drawn to that spark. Now Bob's Big Boy is replete with car hop service, a classic car show every Friday night. Its massive neon sign lights up the twilight, strategically placed to be backlit by glorious western sunsets. That's kind of an instinctive behavior when you live in the West. It seems that no matter where you are, at dusk you must be heading further west into a technicolor sundown. Eventually you dead-end at the Pacific. I've done it many times. It's as if the world says, hey, that's enough. This is where your wanderlust ends. You have no scales or gills or fins. This is as good as it gets. Now turn around, go have a hamburger. A big boy. When I stood in that frigid night taking photographs of a tragic scene, I had no idea that within a few short years, I would lug that same 35mm camera through New Mexico, Arizona, and California, that I would fall crazy in love with desert sand, purple mountains, 12-lane freeways, at a Googie Architecture hamburger joint birthed by a dishwasher named Bob. Or that, after my first taste of the menu, I would, decades later, return with a family I also had never envisioned. I still have that camera. It sits on a shelf where I see it every day. Now and then I'll pick it up and cock the shutter. It still fires. I've no idea if they still make Tri-X black and white film. A funny thing happened when I moved west, away from the monochromatic place that New York is. I never shot another black and white photograph. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Don't forget to stop by the show page for a look at that frozen fire scene. While there, you will find hundreds more episodes as well as links to platforms where you can follow the show between episodes. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and No Agenda Social. You'll also notice the Patreon, PayPal, and post office box address if you'd like to help me keep the lights on here, keep fighting commies and calling out creeps. It's all at thatlarryshow.com. Come back and hang with us again next Wednesday, where we'll be having a very special episode, the fifth birthday of That Larry Show. 5 years. I never imagined it would go this long. I never imagined I'd have so much fun or get to know you, the listeners and supporters who helped me make this endeavor go. If you'd like to be a part of that show, leave me a voicemail at 302-715-2779. If email is your preference, the address is thatlarryshow@gmail.com. We're going to take a look back, fill in some blanks for newer listeners, clip a highlight or three, kick around notions for the future, and most importantly, I'm going to try to thank every person who supports this show by name or alias, because that is long overdue. And since Christmas is fast approaching, we will celebrate 5 years in the salon of the Take No Shit Dojo. That's the plush back room, the inner sanctum for the inner circle, you. We'll have a full stock bar, comfy lounge chairs, a roaring fire, and each other. What could be better? Speaking of Christmas, there are still some of those fabulous That Larry Show key fobs. They make a great stocking stuff for only $10. If you order right away, they might get there before Santa. Details are at thatlarryshow.com. So tell your friends and join us next Wednesday. It's going to be fun. And until that time, take no shit.